Владимир Путин и глава МИДа Сергей Лавров обсуждают
ситуацию на Украине и в Крыму и об отношениях.
Сегодня Владимир Путин провел оперативное совещание с постоянными членами
председатель правительства, спикер обеих палат парламента.
Слова президента, российские войска на Украине.
Встреча, ответное предложение по урегулированию ситуации на Украине.
The game is changing in oh so many ways. Russia's apparent impending annexation of Ukraine's strategic Crimean Peninsula is turning the post-Cold War world on its ear, with the West threatening crippling sanctions, the Kremlin vowing retaliation, and much of the former USSR looking on nervously. The crisis in Ukraine is also changing, perhaps fundamentally, Russia's domestic political arrangements as well. Vladimir Putin's inner circle is shrinking, the ongoing crackdown and dissent in independent media is intensifying, and Russia's economy is bracing for a shock with unpredictable consequences. The Crimea crisis is indeed a game changer, and today we'll take a look at some of those changes. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Russian history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
One of the changes that has become evident, and perhaps this has long been latent and is now only becoming manifest, is that the collective Putin, the Putin Politburo, the inner sanctum of the Russian deep state, if you will, appears to be shrinking. We've talked a lot about this collective Putin, this inner sanctum of the deep state, this Politburo. And in the past, we've always said this elite group of decision makers who de facto ruled Russia was comprised of about a dozen people or so at the inner core. Security service veterans dominated, but technocrats also had a strong voice, and Putin often sided with them against his old KGB buddies. But the reports about how the decision was made to intervene and possibly annex Crimea suggests that only five or six people, all of them Siloviki, were in the loop. This is a change, and this is a change that comes with one of the most important decisions Putin probably has ever made, if I'm not mistaken. The war between the Siloviki and the technocrats appears to be over. And the Siloviki appear to have won decisively, have they not, Mark? You're our Siloviki man.
Well, the question becomes, first of all, what actually is a Silovik? And I don't mean that purely just for the sake of going into detailed analysis of that. But I think you've got to realize that often Siloviki were also technocrats. One of the other ways we've tried to look at the movers and shakers of Russia is managers versus shareholders. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who've made the decisions would seem to be managers. But then we also have someone like Yakunin, who is definitely a shareholder. I think actually what we're seeing, and I agree with you entirely, that this is a very big deal. And it reflects a pretty fundamental and tectonic change within the Putin system, is that actually a lot of the old notions are breaking down. The notion precisely of, you know, Siloviki versus liberal technocrats, of managers versus shareholders and so forth. And in some ways, I think what we're seeing is maybe the end of the deep state as it was once constituted and practiced, and a much, much simpler system emerging, which really is dominated by, shall I say, the FOPs, the friends of Putin, who by definition will
but
often
the FOPs tend to be ex-KGBs.
Yeah, exactly, but that's not why they're there. I mean, in a way, because they're ex-KGB types, they're more likely to be friends of Putin. But on the other hand, you know, as I said, I think we should be wary of simply saying just because you come from a security background, you are necessarily going to be in that inner circle.
I think no, but what this. I mean is the Siloviki as defined by not just from a security background, but having a particular worldview and ideas about how Russia should proceed. It seems like that brand of Siloviki, I mean, we don't even know for sure if Yakunin was ex-KGB. There's a lot of rumors that he was. The others that were supposedly there were of course, Ivanov, of course, ex-KGB, and of course, Siloviki, in my definition, Patrushev, ditto, and Bortnikov, ditto. I find it hard to believe that Sechin wasn't in on this, but I couldn't find him being placed there. Maybe Kirill can add something later on this. But
I'd actually be quite surprised if he was. But I mean, I think it's another name we ought to throw into the mix. And yes, I mean, we have to realize that Yakunin is very different from the others.
Yeah.
Even if he does have an ex-KGB background, that doesn't necessarily mean very much. But I mean, I think, you know, it is becoming increasingly clear that your man Surkov probably played some kind of a role.
I was saying this last week, and you were accusing me of being a conspiracy monger.
Absolutely. Fortunately, what is that? Consistency being the hobgoblin of small minds. No, I mean, I think it's perfectly true. And obviously, and I say this based on facts rather than fanboyishness.
touche.
But clearly, I mean, you know, I think that's interesting because actually, you know, Surkov is on the one hand someone who clearly had and presumably wishes to recreate a close relationship with Putin and yet doesn't come from that ranks of assembled spookery. So, I think that sort of we're talking precisely about people who come from a certain mindset. Set of experiences will often be Silovik. But I think we should be careful of assuming that it's about the mindset or about the background. It's about that tends to mean that they're going to be the closer Putinites. And I think that's it. I think he's shrinking.
Well, yeah, and what are the
Politburo becomes a mini bureau.
What are the implications of that? What are the implications of that shrinking Politburo, the shrinking collective Putin?
Already seen it. Deeply stupid policymaking. Policymaking that is based not on a sort of a careful gathering of facts and a rational cost-benefit analysis, but one which is done much more based on a certain conspiratorial zero-sum view of the world, as well as a rather sort of brashly nationalistic, but Soviet nationalistic, shall we say, or neo-Soviet nationalistic sort of perspective. When we're seeing all that playing out in Crimea and in Ukraine. And that, I think, is why it's such a big deal. Because also, when we start talking about the non-Crimea stuff, these are also people who have a very, very narrow sense of what Russia is like these days.
Exactly, and we're going to get into that throughout the discussion today. Because one of the things that I've noticed, there's several ways that I posted a blog today through the Crimean prism, five new things we've learned about Russia through this crisis. Before I move on to Kirill, Mark, just one, do you see this as a permanent shrinkage or a temporary shrinkage?
I think it becomes very difficult to reverse it. I mean, yes, of course, that when it comes to, I don't know, macroeconomic policy, then there are other voices that will probably end up being heard. But I think what we will see is it's almost like if you looked at, and again, there are limits to the parallel, but the old Soviet system. Central Committee that gathered all the movers and shakers from all the various interest groups. The Politburo, which actually had, you know, sort of the true, shall we say,
key power brokers,
the domain, and who were also divided between full and candidate members. And then you also tended to have these ad hoc little groups that would meet in the walnut room to really decide the important things that then would be presented to the Politburo, sometimes for discussion, sometimes for rubber stamping. So The crucial structure becomes very informal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing. And the reason why, I mean, in the past, obviously, sort of decision-making was often informal. But Putin, in his role as the great arbiter, was aware that he had to bring a whole variety of interest groups on board and also was willing to at least listen to some of them. I think we're seeing that loss. I think we're seeing Putin unable to or unwilling to continue the role of arbiter, and therefore seeking instead just simply to surround himself with cronies.
Mm. And the implications of that, as you said, are stupid policy decisions or maybe much quicker decision-making.
Certainly.
Kirill, you want to jump in here?
Just several considerations. Of course, that is what we see now. It's the end of Putin's regime. I'm not an alarmist. I'm not speaking about that, you know, some democratic revolution is coming and so on. I'm speaking about the particular system which Mark just was speaking about. And another one interesting feature of this, dying system was that, of course, that was all about keeping the power. That was about the play of interests of several parts of, very close elite and so on. But as a side effect of the very existence of this Putin regime was a sort of, you know, national interest.
Mm-hmm.
National interest which could be, in the past, could be just described somehow, explained somehow to the population, to the society, and which could be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see now, it's my second consideration. What we see now, it's disappearing of all, you know, so-called post-Soviet political and social agenda at all.
Mm-hmm.
There is no any matter to discuss now, from now on, because, you know, say 5 years ago, there was several very important questions about the recent state of Russia and the future and the image of future Russia and Russian society. And there were several points of view. And that was, you know, a discussion of all this stuff. Now there is no any hints of the image of future Russia, image of how and where Russia will go on in the nearest future and so on. Everything is disappeared from this, you know, public space of discussion. That means that Putin himself and his close circle absolutely don't interested in all these things. It's all about keeping the power, and that's all. It's not about economy. It's not about social progress or regress or whatever. It's not even about international relationships and so. It's all about himself still going on as a, you know, semi-dictator of semi-authoritarian Russia. And that is a crucial point. That is a point of no return. Because it's not just so important for Putin himself and his nearest circle. It's a very important thing for a Russian society, a Russian opposition, and those who never been engaged in such discussions before.
I mean, I would say there is a little bit of ideological gloss on this. I mean, we've spoken in the past about kind of Putin being the defender of traditional conservative values. And I think I think this all plays into that. I think what he's done is he's thrown his lot entirely in with the most conservative elements in the elite. No, Kirill, you're shaking your head. No,
absolutely. Because you're absolutely right about the situation several weeks ago, and we discussed about this, all this. But now...
But I'm wrong now.
yes, but now what we see that Putin and his advisors, they just rejected the very idea of traditional values, say, of international system of security and sovereignty.
No, but I was talking about traditional values defined.
Yes, but
more
that
in terms
is
of...
the past of a legitimate, you know, attitude to all the stuff. So if you are the defender of traditional values, including sovereignty of the
But they don't include that in their definition of traditional values. Their definition of traditional values means being an Orthodox Christian, not being gay, not being a feminist.
No. And
defining themselves in opposition to the West, in opposition to Western
that
liberal
included,
values.
That included that the borders of the country, say Russia, is sacred.
I would argue that's a traditional value, but I don't think that's one they see. Certainly,
that was one of the most.
But let's Mark, last words on this before we move on to the next thing we've learned about Russia since this crisis.
Okay, I mean, I think it's worth mentioning. You know, traditional Russian values did include intervening. Think of Nicholas I as the gendarme of Europe. But I mean, I'd say to me, I'd want to agree with Kirill in terms of that they have ditched ideology. It's still there as a gloss, but the real measure of ideology is when you follow it, even though it costs you. When it's not something that at the moment, yes, they're playing the sort of nationalist, conservative, traditionalist line because they see that as a sort of one more desperate ploy in order to acquire legitimacy. But it's not, stopping them from divorcing. It's not stopping them from stealing. You know, I mean, it's not actually as if it's something that in any way impinges upon their own existences. So I definitely see this much more as a sort of a ploy rather than anything else.
Well, along these lines, there was a very interesting piece in Foreign Affairs this week by Ivan Krastev that kind of got into some of this, picking up on this idea that Putin essentially wants to go back to the 18th century. No, he wants to return to the Holy Alliance, so to speak, and go back to the 18th century notion of a traditionally great Russia, where you can be an autocrat and there were no consequences for that, as long as you're the defender of traditional values. The other thing we've learned, or at least I think I've learned from this, is that this operation's been being planned, apparently was planned for a while. Or something like this, if you think about it. I mean, less than a year after Putin returned to the Kremlin in May 2012, it's just about a year ago now, he initiated a campaign to force officials who hold assets abroad to repatriate them. This campaign to nationalize the elite was presented as an effort to make Russia less vulnerable to Western pressure. According to media reports, those present at the decision to intervene in Crimea do not have foreign holdings, or at least identifiable and vulnerable ones. And along these lines, it appears that Putin and his shrunken inner circle have decided to sacrifice the economic gains Russia has made over the past decade, and these have been considerable, and they've largely been the result of Russia integrating into the global economy. He's decided to sacrifice these on the altar of imperial ambitions. Mark, would you agree?
No.
No? Okay, go.
No, I mean,
this is
great.
You guys are disagreeing with me today. I love this.
No, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't believe that we should be thinking this as some kind of long-term plan strategy. It was obvious that Putin wanted to, you know, assert himself, that he knew that at times that would bring him into conflict with the West, and that therefore clearly it makes sense to try and minimize the West's ability to affect your elite. It's not that I think he was thinking, oh, in a year's time I might want to invade Crimea.
No, but he was thinking he might want to do something similar. I mean, he was preparing for this. I don't think he was preparing for this exact thing, but this kind of eventuality.
Well, maybe, but I think in some ways this might just as easily, and obviously we're just trying to sort of guess what goes on in that Botoxed head, but is that just as easily is he clearly, he doesn't just say this anti-Western rhetoric. He believes it. So I think he might also have thought, look, the West is going to try and get at me, rather than thinking I'm going to do something that's going to pee the West off. West was going to come and get at him. So, you know, basically he was kind of proofing himself. I mean, the trend towards that, the trend towards media control and so forth, I think they all fit into a pattern of sort of how Putin saw his regime evolve. But on the other hand, where I would want to absolutely agree with you is that now, as he depends more upon people who don't have exposure to the West and Western sanctions and so forth, increasingly what this means is that a situation has been created whereby his little mini-bureau is actually going to find itself, its interests, in stark contrast to those of the mass of the elite. Because on the whole, the elite is a globalized one, it's one that wants to be globalized. And it's all very well a handful of people saying, well, we're all right because we haven't got apartments in Prague or Florida or whatever, and we haven't got bank accounts in England. But then there's going to be the rest of them, people on whom they actually depend to run the country, who are saying, well, hang on a minute. Actually, I wanted to be able to have my apartment elsewhere and send my kids to university around the world and all those sort of things. So, I mean, I think this is actually I don't think for a minute that Putin has thought it through in these terms, but I think it's potentially a really dangerous and divisive step.
Yes, this could very fundamentally divide the elite. But do you think that that Putin and his mini bureau, as we've come to call it, have made the decision to kind of retrench from the global economy?
Russia can't begin. I think this is why when I say about sort of frankly bad decision making, no. I don't think for a minute they've done that, because if nothing else, you know, the thought of basically looking to North Korea as your model is pretty unlikely. I mean, they can't do that. They cannot unpick Russia from the world economy, at least not without dramatic economic implications.
They can, but with dramatic economic implications.
Yeah, and I think on that, basically, the Kremlin lives or dies by its ability to manage the economy and manage the distribution of goodies. So, I mean, I think they understand that. I honestly think it's just precisely because you have a handful of people who are around Putin now who do not understand how the world works. They don't understand how much of the elite works. And therefore, they're making short-term decisions rather than thinking, OK, 6 months down the line, 12 months down the line, How is this going to play out? Right. And no one dares or is able to actually knock on their door and say, excuse me, have you thought about X?
Well, I agree with you. They're much more vulnerable than they seem to think they are. And I would point to today, just hours ago, here at RFRL, we put out a very excellent report by one of our best writers, Robert Coulson, that took a look at how vulnerable Russia really is to sanctions and how vulnerable the West is to Russian retaliation. And I was surprised by what we found here is that it basically comes down to energy versus finance, basically. Russia provides energy to Europe. Europe provides finance to Russia. But Russia's much more dependent upon Western finance. In fact, it is entirely dependent upon Western finance than the West is to Russian energy. Losing Russian energy would certainly hurt, but it would not cripple Europe's economy. Over time, Europe would find other sources and would get by, especially in the summer, by the way, in the spring. But a cutoff of credits would cripple some of Russia's biggest companies. So there's right now $8 billion worth of loans that are under threat right now because of the Crimea crisis. So I would recommend anybody take a look at that piece. It's up on our website right now. Kirill, what are your thoughts on this bit of the discussion?
Several points. First of all, those who are surrounded Putin now, they are not just poorly informed about the way our world is going. They're just totally ignorant. And that is very important. They are the officers of some, secret service. And that's all. They are not specialized in the international relationships, in the economy, and so on. They think about the world as a place of where running by special operations, not by politics, not by some economic measures or even economic laws and so on. It's all just about their voluntarist idea of special, secret or semi-secret operations, which are, changing the face of the world. And that is very interesting, because when we see the second point, when we see trying to think about those who are absolutely silent today, who are silent now? Russian oligarchs. Absolutely. Yes, I never met any remarks about the situation made by, Deripaska or even Mikhail Prokhorov, who thinks about himself as a political leader.
I saw some interesting remarks by Lebedev. Now he's not in this category of oligarchs you were talking about, but it's what he said was interesting. This is quoted by the New York Times. He's saying he's met a lot of people from Russia who are on the on the Forbes list, so to speak, and they are ashen, they are gray, they're pale, they're just baffled by this and don't know what to do. But he also added it's very unlikely they're going to oppose Putin on this. So they're going to take a hit for sure.
And the very important thing, the consequence of all these events, is the very existence of so-called Russian elite, economical, financial elite, political elite, and so on. Their involvement or their, role as a part of this elite now, is put to the test. If they can defend themselves, if they can make a sort of influence on the decisions and so on, being quite brave. Of course, I understand that it's very, serious situation. It's very hard to do something, but we will go on as a so-called, Russian elite. If no, Russian elite doesn't exist anymore. And that's important because this elite with the upper part of this, including oligarchs and the middle level of so-called mini-garchs and so on, that was a sort of pillow between the Putin himself and the state and the society. And that was a very important role. Of course, they are not, saints and so on, but one of the most important tasks of this financial and political elite is to soften the situation between the state and the society. And if something is happening, they, you know, just pay for Olympic Games or, you know, whatever. Right. And that was, of course, I am not sure that was a right structure for democratic society and state and so on. But anyway,
I'm pretty sure that it wasn't. But
yes, yes, okay. But if they disappear, Putin and the society will see each other face to face, and that's a very important implication. And the third one is the very idea of state. With the nuclear weapons and so on, which is running by, you know, several absolutely ignorant and being in a very strange state of mind, security service officers, it's very dangerous for all the world.
Yeah,
and that's very important. And Putin must understand that from now on, he is a personal enemy of the United States and the leaders of the European Union.
And
that is the point of no return.
Yes, no, and one of the things that made me think we have crossed a very, very important line this week is the behavior of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. If you saw her comments in the Bundestag yesterday, this was as far as I've seen a German leader speak, as harshly as I've seen a German leader speak of Russia since the end of the Cold War. There was an interesting piece in the Times this week about Merkel and about how she's basically at her wit's end with Putin. She's been talking to Putin more than any other Western leader, and she can't get through to him, and it's driving her crazy, and it's making her fundamentally rethink the German approach to Russia, which is keep talking to them, keep talking to them. It's been much more conciliatory than the Anglo-American approach has been historically. If Russia loses Germany as a ally, so to speak, within the European camp, that's a big, big, big loss. Before we move on, Mark, what are your thoughts on that before we move on to the next section?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the thing is that Putin historically has always sort of played his cards very carefully, known how far to push, and known ultimately that there are people on, shall we say, the other side of the fence who want to believe, who want to make a deal, who want to think ultimately that Putin is like them, maybe with a certain sort of, you know, ideological flourish and bare-chested machismo, but nonetheless basically like them, and therefore that they sort of shared some certain common grounds. When Merkel made her earlier comment about Putin being in another world, I mean, I think that very much epitomizes it, that sense that this is someone with whom, you know, there is absolutely no common ground. And I think when that becomes the norm, and as I think it may well, especially if things get even worse in Ukraine, in Western circles, then the issue becomes, well, it's not about how we get on with Russia, it's how we deal with Russia.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's a very sort of important Rubicon to cross.
And I think we've crossed it. Kirill, last word very briefly before we move into the second half.
How could we deal with not with Russia, but with Putin himself? That's the most important thing, that Putin himself became a personal enemy of, you know, democratic states and organizations. And that is very important. Putin instead Russia. He is not sharing his responsibility. He is absolutely responsible for all this crisis.
Which will make him potentially vulnerable, depending on how this crisis turns out. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion of how the Crimea crisis is changing the game in Russia. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us from London, and also via Skype, is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
I think that what's happening is a particular sort of censorship and pressure on the editorial staff. This violates the mass media law. Everyone understands what's going on. It doesn't require any additional explanation.
Russia's netroots are feeling the pressure. Several opposition websites, including Grani.ru, Kasparov.ru, and Yezhdnevny Zhurnal, are now blocked. And so are remaining independent journalists feeling the pressure as well. The editor of the news site Lenta.ru got fired after publishing material about Ukraine that the Kremlin deemed extremist. We just heard from a journalist from Lenta.ru discussing that at the beginning of this segment. These are just the latest examples of an ongoing crackdown on dissent that appears to have intensified as the crisis in Ukraine has escalated. Consider, in late January, the popular social networking site Vkontakte came under Kremlin control when Pavel Durov, its founder and CEO, was pressured into selling his remaining shares. In early February, Dosh TV's main satellite and cable providers announced, one after another, that they would stop carrying the channel, effectively barring it from the airwaves after the station came under fire for a controversial poll about the Leningrad blockade during World War II. And on February 28th, a day before Russia started making its moves in Crimea, a Moscow court placed opposition leader Alexei Navalny under house arrest, barring him from speaking to the media and using the internet. The pattern seems to be clear, Mark, does it not?
Yeah, and again, I think it reflects this change in the political system. When politics is about managing varying elite coalitions, then it's important to have fora in which differences of opinion can be aired, because that's one of the ways in which you sort of understand and build these coalitions. If that's gone, if in fact they're just simply one core element of the elite who give the orders, then you don't need multiple perspectives in the media. All you really want is propaganda. Likewise, dissent. Dissent can be considered to be a safety valve if it's appropriate levels of dissent. However, when it comes to, when you're in a system in which there is only one conceivable, acceptable official line, you're in the realm of Paderonostev, orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationalism, then dissent, it can be nothing but corrosive and just downright wrong. So again, I think, yes, just as we have seen this shrinking of Putin's circle, in line with shrinking of Putin the man, so too the need, the desire, the tolerance for all these forms of civil society becomes all the less.
Even if it's managed civil society. And I think you're onto something, and this leads to where I want to go with this, is that basically that works fine if you have an undifferentiated mass in society, as you had in more or less in the Soviet Union. But it doesn't work so much if you have a significant segment of society, indeed an entire generation, that has grown up expecting to be globalized, has grown up expecting to be bourgeois, has grown up expecting to have its own media. And now suddenly they're shutting that off, just as a lot of the elite isn't exactly going to be down with Fortress Russia, pulling itself back from the global economy. A good section of society is going to be unhappy with this as well, one would think. Maybe I'm wrong. No?
Well, one would think. I mean, it's worth noting, on the other hand, that at the moment, Putin's popularity ratings are up and up and up. And that actually says something, that essentially as the ruble and as the economy goes down, Putin's popularity goes up. What does that say? Well, I think precisely that at the moment, Putin can count on the true loyalty of a small fraction of the elite, the pragmatic acquiescence loyalty of more of the elite, just simply because who wants to buck the trend, and a certain proportion of the Russian masses who aren't, after all, the people who otherwise would be sending their kids to expensive American universities. Or
but
whatever.
It is people who would be taking their not so expensive vacations in Prague or Turkey, and so soon that might not be possible.
Yeah, but again, that's assuming. I mean, I don't think anyone is currently sort of thinking in those terms, in terms of the wider masses. I mean, that's several sort of falls of dominoes beyond that. And I think that's where it'll definitely hit. But I think the key thing, again, this is to go back to Sarah Kirill's point about the dwindling, the disappearance or whatever of that intermediary force, that intermediary social presence between Tsar Putin and his loyal subjects. As that diminishes, Putin's popularity ratings go up because the loyal subjects are more numerous than the elite. But who actually runs the state? Who is absolutely vital for that? It's that intermediary level who are currently the ashen-faced ones who have a better sense of what Russia has to lose.
Hmm. But is that popularity sustainable? I mean, is it, as this begins to bite, and I don't mean that people are going to be barred from traveling. You're right. We're several falls of the domino away from that. But sooner or later, the implications and the fallout from all of this are going to begin to hit this part of the population. And it's larger than just this urban middle class, people who expect to be able to live a certain way now and have come to expect that. Once the economy starts to take a hit, for example, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of different ways that people's lifestyles have become accustomed to, whether it means being able to read Grani Ru and watch Dosh TV, or whether it means being able to send your kid, and it's not just the elite that's sending their kids to schools in the West, or go on vacations in the West, as that begins to chip away. And that's the implication of what we've been discussing up to this point.
But I think, again, that's a slightly sort of longer-term thing. I mean, I agree entirely. And it's often going to be silly things like, you know, if the ruble plummets, then that German dishwasher that you wanted to buy suddenly becomes unaffordable. And, you know, you'd hope to buy a European car, you're going to have to buy something else instead. But we've already talked in previous podcasts before this crisis about the fact that there were inescapable bad times ahead for the economy, and that was inevitably going to have a deeply corrosive effect on Putin's popularity ratings. And I think what we're seeing precisely is the likelihood, the near certainty, that in one way or another, this Crimean expedition is going to worsen and accelerate those bad times. I think that is definitely going to hit his popularity ratings overall. But in this respect, I'm an unashamed elitist. I'm much, much less engaged by whether or not his popularity ratings are 67, 57, or even 47%, as long as there's not actually an election. If he loses the support of the elite, then that doesn't really matter if he's got two-thirds of the masses on his side.
Mm. Kirill?
Just imagine, opinion poll in December 1916 in Russia. The result will be, you know, a great support for Nicholas II. And so, of course, I'm not against, you know, the sociology as a science and so on, but we must understand that, first of all, there are several opinion polls, and for instance, Levada Center gave just 32% for Putin.
Really?
Levada
I saw had him in the 60s.
Yes. No.
When did that come out?
There were two different numbers. First of all, who is supporting now Putin? 32%. And who maybe will vote for him if a presidential election will
60s.
Be now. Yeah,
and that was
the 60s. And that is the difference, and we can discuss it. And it's a very important difference, firstly. Secondly, of course, we entered a situation of a great instability. And, yesterday's opinion polls, say nothing about today and especially about tomorrow. Mm. Secondly, returning to the issue of censorship and the closing of Lenta, Dosht, and so on, I already told about the ignorance of all these people who are now the advisors of Putin and so on. That the same thing I can say about even the technical level of this new course. Because Russian state, repressive state, is prepared for previous war, not for the recent war.
Mm.
Media war I am speaking about. Of course, they can close, Dosht, Lenta, Navalny's blogs and so on. But they will find out that tomorrow there will be, 1,000 blogs, different, mm-hmm. with different names and so on. And that's more important. The very position, political and ideological position of people who were not, such in a greater position to Putin 2 years ago, will be in this position mm-hmm. after all this stuff. And I can predict that, you know, in 1 month, we will have, you know, hundreds and hundreds very popular, extremely popular blogs, which are much more radical than even Navalny was. And it's absolutely stupid because with the help of Usmanov and Mahmoud and some other oligarchs, Kremlin could control even Lenta.ru, Gazeta.ru, and some other medias.
Live journal. But,
yes, live journal and so on. But they can't do this no more. They are losing control because of their own policy. So that is very important.
Well, you brought up Navalny, and I think he gives a great segue to the last thing I want to discuss. So let's just quickly dispense of the issue of Mr. Navalny. Am I being conspiratorial in thinking that, you know, February 28th, Navalny's placed under house arrest? We discussed it here in the podcast, wondering if that might be an effort to prevent a Euromaidan from happening in Russia. Remember, God, how quaint it is to be thinking about that. That was only a couple weeks ago. But now, taking this in the context of everything we're discussing here, the website closures and everything that's going on, it certainly does look like an effort to silence Navalny, given what they had cooking then that we didn't know about then, but we know about now, right? Doesn't it look like that was an effort to silence Navalny, who was very outspoken on the Ukrainian crisis? Mark?
I still think that they silenced Navalny because he was an irritant. They silenced Navalny because they had an opportunity. And yes, they silenced Navalny because of the Maidan meant that they were particularly sort of conscious of not allowing people who could become the grains of sand around which the pearl of resistance could cohere.
But don't you think they silenced him because they were about to go into Crimea and the last thing they needed was him riling up the streets?
I'm not sure. Again, I think that is presuming a level of joined-up thinking that I don't think we see. And as I said, I don't think one needs to. Occam's razor should surely come in. You know, they dislike Navalny. In their own way, they feared Navalny. They had a perfect opportunity to silence him. They'd realized from how they
handled had plenty of opportunities in the past, but they chose to do it on February 28th.
Well, I mean, they chose to do it at the point where, as it were, he gave them their latest opportunity during the whole, you know, Maidan-inspired.
Well, no, it was done under the auspices of the Yves Rocher case, if I'm not mistaken, which is.
Oh no, but I mean, Maidan had brought the Kremlin to particularly sort of aware of this issue. I mean, it could be. As I said, maybe it's I'm actually doing them a disservice, and they are more Machiavellian than I'm thinking. But I just feel they're still, at the moment, they're running on instinct and reflex rather more than plan.
Right. Kirill, what are your thoughts?
I think our mistake that we presumed that all these measures by Kremlin are rational.
They seem to fit a pattern.
Yes, first of all. And secondly, it's more interesting, you know, in some perspective. Well, now we have a struggle over the very issue of Russian nationalism between Navalny and Putin himself. It's interesting because Putin and his propaganda tried to steal the whole nationalist issue from Navalny. And
to a degree, they're succeeding. Tomorrow, there's going to be a march in support of Kremlin policies organized by a nationalist group. Do you see Izvestia this week? On March 10th, there was an article by Prakhanov. I mean, Prakhanov, who was a marginal figure in the 1990s. Let me remember, this is the editor of Dien, which was shut down, the editor of Zavtra. Now he's getting like highly prominent placement in Izvestia. With an article singing the praises of Putin. There was a good piece in Politcom this week about this very issue, about how the nationalists suddenly have forgotten about migration. They're singing Putin's praises because all they want to talk about is recapturing Crimea. They seem to have taken away Navalny, or in the process of taking away Navalny's nationalist thunder. You disagree. Maybe you know more than me. Go.
I don't know that if I know more than you, but anyway, you take Prakhanov too seriously, I think.
And I don't take Prakhanov seriously. I take the fact that his article is in Izvestia.
Izvestia is not, a serious media no more.
It's where the Kremlin puts its approved message out.
It's,
seriousness is in the eye of the beholder.
As serious media now, which is, you know, quite neutral, is Vedomosti, is...
No, I can agree. Vedomosti is a good paper, but it's not where the Kremlin puts its line out. The Kremlin puts its line out in Izvestia.
Yes, but the question is who's reading this Izvestia, and that's
the elite answer. Is looking to Izvestia for signals, is who's reading Izvestia.
The most interesting thing is if you read the latest, maybe the last web post by Navalny in his live journal blog, it's a very clever text. He's trying to be a nationalist in the situation of a nationalist propaganda and at the same time to be in a position to Putin. Mm-hmm. He is trying to invent some so-called people's nationalism.
This was posted by his wife, presumably, since he's forbidden from using the internet.
Okay. His wife. But anyway, it's very interesting because he's opposing the invasion to Crimea and all these things. And at the same time, the rhetoric is slightly anti-Muslim. There were some mentioning about people from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and so on. He's mentioning, as far as I remember, some Chechnya stuff. Very negatively. And at the same time, he used the word Hakhli for Ukrainians, which is quite insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he's, trying to...
Interesting,
support,
since he's half Ukrainian.
Yes. Of course, he's trying to be, some kind of narodne, like people's quite nationalistic, but at the same time, clever man, muzhik. Mm. And he succeeded in this. It's a very, entertaining text.
It's an entertaining text. But, Mark, what do you think? Have they cut Navalny's legs out from under him here, both with the house arrest and by kind of stealing his nationalist thunder?
Yeah, I think it's interesting precisely because it reframes once again what nationalism is about. We've seen this pendulum swing. Originally, it was sort of Putin beating his breast about sort of Russia's place in the world. Then we had Navalny come along and essentially steal that particular chalice by saying, no, it's about needing visas and all these strange dark faces in Moscow. And now, precisely, that just at the time when they've conveniently sort of put him away, in some ways it's also convenient for him, actually, because he's now not being doorstopped by people saying, tell us what you think about the Crimea.
Although he's putting it out in his blog, or at least somebody's putting it out for him.
That's a nice crafted message.
Yeah, you don't have
rather
right
than actually anything
else. Being doorstep,
I think it's entirely true. I mean, it's fascinating about Prokhanov. Again, it simply as a symbol coming up. I mean, this was the Nightingale of the General Staff. He was the cheerleader for Afghanistan, and he's been stuck in deep freeze, and now he's been defrosted in time for the Crimea. it is, in so many ways, a marvelous symbol of the way that we actually have a Soviet nationalism, which is essentially a sort of an imperialist state nationalism, a super state nationalism, competing against...
A
Russian ethnic nationalism. And actually, that most of the sort of adherents can cope with either in a way.
Right.
So it's not a straightforward case of there are two different types of nationalists and who will win. It's actually that there are nationalists who are willing to be defined and redefined as circumstances and propaganda and so forth allows in many ways.
Well, one of the things I noted on the blog, too, is that, Putin, since losing the middle class back in the winter of 2011, 2012, turned to the working class populism. But one big key component that was missing from that was the nationalists, because Navalny had stolen those. Well, now they are getting at least some of them back. And you have to wonder if that's going to be a workable coalition for Putin going forward in all of this.
I mean, he never has coalitions. I mean, I think coalition implies almost a sort of two-way
process.
I'm speaking
metaphorically.
No, but I think it's important that precisely the thing is that Putin can win them because he rolls into the Crimea. That's fine. But then a year hence, how does he keep them won?
By rolling into eastern Ukraine, northern Kazakhstan.
Well, I mean, there is a certain point that actually, if that's seriously part of the political calculation, it's something that has to be reasserted. And that's quite an alarming thought.
Well, no, this is a very alarming thought and definitely the subject of a future podcast. I'd like to get into it more of it today, but I think we'll have to devote an entire podcast to what is the geopolitical, what are the geopolitical aims. Last thoughts. We have just a few minutes before we go, tying all these things together. Mark?
Okay. I would say that I think that what we see with Crimea is, Crimea is important, clearly. It's tremendously important geopolitically and so forth in its own right. But I also think that equally Crimea is important because it's the first really big, obvious expression of this change we've seen within the Russian political system. And I think reasons that many analysts, and I hold my hands up, myself included, were behind the curve in predicting what was going on was precisely because we were, as it were, sticking with Putin 2.0, and we're now having to deal with Putin 3.0.
Uh-huh, the upgraded Putin. Kirill.
Well, now, the later Putin.
The later Putin. Kirill, last thoughts briefly.
I think the situation is very dangerous and very bad, not just, you know, for Crimean population or Russian population, but for Putin himself. I think that the loss of rationality in his measures and in the very he deconstructed his own political system, and now he's face to face to his own population. He's as one of the sociologists put it, he's no Teflon anymore. Teflon cover on the saucepan and so on. So, and that is the greatest danger for him, because he's not a national leader like General de Gaulle and so on. He cannot play with the people, with the nation, as a national leader in all the meanings of this term. He was quite a secret agent who's quite skillful during, you know, the previous periods. And from now on, he must play the new role. And I think and absolutely sure that he will fail. And I'm quite nostalgic about the times of Putin 1.0 and 2.0.
I never thought we would say that. And on that note, we'd wrap up, and we'll see soon enough whether or not Putin has kept his Teflon. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.